I always find it fascinating what happens to us when we're when we're just quiet and still. Not moving, not talking, not relating. I think it's probably the most disruptive thing a human being can do compared to what goes on inside of us all of the time and outside of us all of the time and what we feel we are obliged to be doing all of the time. This is the opposite, just being quiet and being still. So the first thing that happens when we're quiet and still is that we encounter ourselves, our so-called selves. We encounter what is going on just underneath our conscious awareness for most of the day and through the night, although we're not aware of it at night unless we're awake. Lots of agitation and lots of what I call the accumulation of a lifetime of the five senses eating and the mind, because of its structure, because of the brain structure, and because of our tendencies as a species, as well as a culture, a society, a family, individuals. Our five senses eat experience and convert it into a questionable meat and potato loaf. And that's what we encounter when we get quiet, the agitation of it all, and the pain that it is creating in our bodies as well as our minds and hearts. So I notice that people come to the meditation as if we're going to the salt mines. And sometimes it feels like hard work. But there are times during a sitting when there is a relief. And we can say in Tibetan Buddhism, there's an expression, the sunrise experience. There's the experience of the body becoming light. And even though our eyelids are closed, we seem to see golden light. There's a relief because the mind finally feels confident enough that we're going to survive without it agitating. Most of the time, we feel that we have to be active to survive. We have to think a lot. We have to take in a lot through our senses. We have to do a lot. We have to buy a lot. We have to say a lot. We have to read a lot. We have to achieve a lot. But just being still and being quiet is a radical shift from that frenzy. So I think that one of the things that we are when we practice, we become lion tamers. Our mind is like a lion. It's absolutely determined to defend us, to protect us, to take care of us. But it needs some training in how to do this, how to be focused, how to understand the noise factors, and allow them to recede and melt away, and how to hone in on what is important. What is really, really valuable for us to experience in this moment? Meditation and the practice of Vipassana is all about being in the moment. The mind likes to review the past and project the future. And it is constantly reiterating old stories, old saws. In fact, any time of the day, I invite you to wake up and notice what is going on in your mind at this moment. And you will realize that there's been continual jabberwocky, talking, discussing, discoursing, telling stories. And most of it is underneath our conscious awareness. We don't even realize it's happening until we wake up in the moment and say, oh my God, I'm driving myself crazy. And it's true, we do. Not only do we drive ourselves crazy, but we create lots of stress that way. And the mind's hyperactivity is itself a product of the stress. So I sometimes work in corporations where people are of necessity having to focus and grabbing attention and fixing it to a task. And the question is, what keeps us from being able to just focus on one thing? It's the noise factor. It's all the emotions behind anything that we are trying to achieve, whether it's personal or work-oriented, relationship, or just getting across the street. In this constant turmoil and agitation, what we create is what in Buddhism is called dukkha, the suffering of things that are constantly being agitated, internal to ourselves. It's true that the world, by nature, is in a constant state of disequilibrium. Everything is always changing and not as solid as it seems to us. But inside, we're like an ocean that is always roiling, always disturbing, always creating emotions and reactions and responses. So one of the things that I like to train people who are at work and need to pay attention in is how to recognize when we go from enthusiasm, you know, when you first meet somebody or you first get a task or, you know, you're through the interview process and you start your new job, there's a lot of enthusiasm and curiosity and excitement. And that's adrenaline, the adrenaline rush. But soon, sometimes, sadly, much too soon, it goes into worry and a feeling of, I don't know if I can do this, and who are these people that I'm working with, and do I have enough time, am I smart enough, will people recognize my abilities, or will they start criticizing me? Soon it goes from adrenaline to cortisol, stress. And when we are in a state of stress, we're right on the verge of having chronic subconscious anxiety that is ongoing all of the time. So I like to ask people in the work world, do you think that you can pay attention to your mind-body process enough to be able to discriminate when the adrenaline becomes cortisol? When we go from enthusiasm to stress and anxiety? So that's my question in this room tonight. Has anybody here been able to determine when there's that uprising of, oh, great, this is going to be fun, this is going to be challenging, but I'm going to enjoy it, to, oh, my God, I don't know if I can do this, and I don't want other people to witness me failing? Do you have a sense of when you cross that boundary? So being able to pay attention carefully enough to be able to detect micro changes in our biology, in our brain neurology, and the effect that it has on how we feel in our body, in our emotions, and in our hearts. That's the fruit of deep practice. That's the promise. That's what we can attain. That level of self-awareness. What I call going from compulsion to choice. So a realistic description of freedom. If we're in choice, we're free. If we're in compulsion, we're driven. And we have no way to as a teacher of mine said, drive our own bus. It is being driven for us. The problem when we're in a compulsive state is that we're in a state of suffering. So one of the first things that people encounter when they meditate is the suffering of the body, the suffering of the mind, the suffering in our hearts. And that's the challenge, how to open up to the experience as we find it in each moment, no matter what it is. It's a revelation of the truth of who we are in that moment. And it is our intimate relationship with ourselves. It is an intense intimacy that we run away from. And when we run away from intimacy with ourselves, guess what? We run away with intimacy from intimacy with others, with life, with this whole experience we call being alive. So it's a kind of agonizing sleepwalking that we do. So I was just given a very interesting article by an interesting Dharma teacher, Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, talking about Buddhist practice as something that is very, very self-oriented. Here we are, year after year, Tuesday evening after Tuesday evening, retreat after retreat, doing this intimate confrontation with ourselves as we find ourselves in each moment, being in the middle of a world that is on fire. More than ever, we realize that our little planet is not going to be able to survive us, or we will not be able to survive on this planet in our habituated state of being comfortable and being provided for. Oxygen, clean water, clean air, clean food, relatively normal climates. Every day, if you turn on the radio or the TV, there is a blast of news that is more and more tragic. The way people relate to each other. Noami just said, what about the girls in Nigeria? Kidnapped, haven't seeing where they are, don't know how to rescue them, don't know what's going on with them, don't know what they're being subjected to, or if they'll ever return to whatever life is normal for them. So the crimes that people commit in relation to each other, as well as the tragedies of the climate. Just this past week, Bosnia, that has had its own problems for so long, people problems, now had 3 months worth of rain within 3 days, flooded out, mudslides, people losing their homes, their fields, their crops, their lives. Farm animals drowning, the carcasses floating to the surface, threatening all kinds of illnesses. And another thing that is floating to the surface is landmines. So, natural factors combining with the factors that people have inflicted on each other, on ourselves, turning into a miasma of disaster. And what to do? What to do? So, Bhikkhu Bodhi says, Buddhism has been associated with sitting and clarifying ourselves and not necessarily having an interest or a relationship to what is going on outside of ourselves and wanting to have an impact or somehow or other get engaged, contribute, have a voice. be helpful in sustaining some balance in an unbalanced world. And I don't think that Bhikkhu Bodhi wants us to go out and become crusaders. But we shouldn't use practice as a way of insulating ourselves from everything that is going on all around us, every moment of every day, every year. Being open to the tragedies as well as the joys. Being open to a feeling of helplessness, as well as being in touch with whatever resources we might be able to share. I know down at Google they have a center where their one focus is to gather resources that will be helpful in crises, wherever they're happening, all over the planet, and somehow or other put together the resources with the people who are needing them as quickly as possible. So there is recognition that we are resourceful and that we can do things and that we even have the technology to create those kind of networks if we keep our eyes and hearts open. We, each one of us in this room, have some way of connecting and being able to find a means for being a source of wholesomeness, goodness, even if it's just sharing information. Bearing witness is very, very important, because some of the darkest things happen when the backs are turned. So if nothing else, we are waking up not only to what is going on within our bodies and minds and hearts, but what is going on outside, with a sense of steadiness and calm and clarity. We can find ways of having influence that will be beneficial to ourselves and others and all creatures, human and otherwise, that are at the mercy of the natural mind, untamed by attention and practice, and the nature of humanity, untamed by wisdom and insight. So I would love to hear from you how you utilize your practice, how you find it, how it affects you, whether you feel empowered by it or isolated by it. If you have questions or insights to share, I think everybody in the room will be happy to listen. I know I would. I know it's interesting to revel in silence. This is one time when I ask questions of the group or in any Dharma group, when it's time to maybe find your own voice, it's nice to be in silence. Even though being in silence is one of the things that terrifies people the most about retreats, it's also an escape, isn't it? So come out of your silence and yes. 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 It's interesting. Well, I'm so glad that you've had, this is one of the great fruits of the practice, is to be able to gauge minute shifts and changes and to say, wait a minute, do I want to go there? It's even in our colloquial, don't go there. Or Let's go there instead. And one of the ways of having that kind of mastery, if you will, is to be able to still the mind. When you find it going on and on and on and on and on, you can say, okay, let's just take a moment and be quiet. And then you have a chance. That is already having an intervention, so to speak, into the mind, which is just roiling around like a wheel in the wind, a spin wheel. But yeah, so if for you, you don't necessarily know if you're doing it right. I have a wonderful friend who says you cannot meditate wrong. You can't do it wrong. But if you have those specific fruits and they're pointed out for you, you can say, wow, that's pretty cool. Because it, have you experienced it as beneficial to be able to have that level of insight? Yes, that's a good choice, isn't it? That's right. Especially in the work world where things are really, really intense and it feels like survival, you know. There's the agitation level, the thermometer of agitation gets really, 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 really hot. And that's when we say things that we wish we'd never said and do things that we know we wouldn't do if we had been cool and collected. So we have that opportunity to calm down and to regain a center of balance. And from that place, we're smarter, we're more effective. We have more intentionality about how we affect other people. And that's a great place to experience the expansiveness of that level of choice. Yeah. As well as in the heat of personal relationships. As well as, you know, what happens to us when we're reading the news or listening to the news. I was yesterday on NPR. There was a program. They were talking about cruelty to farm animals. And how there's a whole group of people who herd of pigs when they're being transported to the slaughterhouse. They're crammed in these, you know, metal container trucks with just tiny little holes for air. And one time last summer, it was so hot in the Midwest, and they had absolutely no water. When they arrived just to the slaughterhouse, people were waiting for them and gave them water and gave them love before they went and got killed. And just hearing that, it was this wave. I thought my heart was going to break. But then I could step back from that, the agitation that was beginning in me, you know. Doesn't mean that I don't feel it and I don't recognize that these things exist and that I want to become callous to it. But it means I can preserve my energy instead of getting hysterical and dramatic. So for me, in my personality type, with the accumulation of what my mind and body have been doing in this lifetime, that's my challenge. Don't get dramatic. Acknowledge emotions, but don't dramatize them, you know? Acknowledge the reality of the experience of beings, but stay balanced in that experience and bear witness. That's what these people were doing. They didn't have a chance. They were affecting the pigs' experience a little bit, but they couldn't deflect them from their fate. They were just bearing witness. Sometimes simply bearing witness has its own profound effectiveness. So, in part, when we practice within ourselves, we bear witness to our own process. And that bearing witness has a very powerful effect on what happens to us internally. Just as bearing witness as a group, as a species, has a powerful effect on what happens to us in the larger picture. And also the impact that we as a species have on this planet. I don't know if any of you have been watching Neil deGrasse Tyson's series, Cosmos. It streams for free on Hulu. It's a huge, huge, vast, vast, you know, he talks in terms of trillions of years and things being light years away and the waves of light and the waves of sound and the birth of the red star and the white star and the death of stars and the vastness of space and time. And it's so liberating and awesome and mind-blowing to be positioned in such a huge, vast universe and be relieved of our self-importance. Yeah. Hi. This thesis here?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And I did, I really, I don't know if I was fair, but absolutely, I think that we can't really be a positive influencer until we have some kind of balance within ourselves, and insight can kind of percolate gently through that sense of clarity and balance, and we can have wise action. Without wise action, what are we really doing? We're just reacting, and we're probably becoming violent ourselves. And so I agree with you completely that meditation is a way of creating effectiveness in who we are and how we engage both with ourselves and with the world. And without clarity and without the wisdom and the insight that are the fruits of meditation, what are we doing? Yeah. I agree. So it's both and. Yeah. Yeah. Although I have to say, over the years of teaching and participating in long retreats, I have found some individuals who hide in the practice. You know, it's easy to just kind of like pull the hoodie way down and say, okay, you know, let the world be what it is. I'm just here in my own world. So it can be an escape. But it's a difficult escape because you're still with yourself. And self is not a limited experience. It begins to include larger and larger and larger facets. So it's difficult to do practice without opening up to the infinite and everything in it. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. A structure of what? Right. I don't know that it's a selfishness. It's a form of passivity, maybe. Things are what they are. And there's the karma, you know, there's an interpretation of karma. You are suffering because you had bad lives and bad choices and you were an evil person. And then you have infinite other lifetimes to work it out. So we've got lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of time. So why worry about, you know, you're having leprosy now? And you know, why figure out how to bring cheap antibiotics to this group, to this leper colony, when, you know, this is their condition? And who are we to feel that we can have an impact and an influence on them? So, yeah, I think that when the Dharma came to the West, it encountered a society that felt they wanted intervention. They wanted to feel personal initiative. And that's our whole thing, is we can do what we want, we have choice, we have dominion, we can take crusades to the other worlds and convince them of our values. And so there was this clash, in a way, and we're just beginning to work it out. And it's going to take a few generations, if not more, while we come to this new integration, however it takes shape, and hopefully the planet can last that long. We're just beginning to open up, and we're San Francisco people. We're all kind of politically liberal. We believe in climate change, but we're only really, really beginning to feel the sensory experience of what could happen to us at any moment, because we're in a drought, we have winds every night, and that's the perfect setting for wildfires. So, you know, we can see other places drowning, but we're not necessarily free of being in the eye of the storm ourselves. And it's a cause for being awake, being wakeful, and not throwing our hands up and feeling apathetic or helpless, but staying awake, because bearing witness has an incredible power. And you end up talking about it, you end up listening, and somehow or other, in a magical way, you can say, you begin to align people and resources that invite you. There's portals that you find in front of you that you can go through and have an influence. So it's all based on intention and staying awake to things, even if they're uncomfortable. And that's one of the things about the practice. You know, the body can become uncomfortable sitting still because it's used to agitating. It's like the mind. The mind is like a wild elephant. It just goes everywhere, all of the time. But what does it take to sit and be awake and alert through discomfort? We have a very low tolerance for any kind of discomfort. And it's a limitation. And it weakens us. It limits our capacity to be all of who we can be, as they say, in the West. So, being able to be uncomfortable is part of what allows us to be open to the cruelty and the suffering and the pain of ourselves and the rest of the world, as well as the joy and the happiness. When we cut off one side of the sensory system, we cut off the whole of the sensory system. But yeah. 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 Not me.
I'm the one who gave the article.
Yes, it's all your fault. And I just cursorily read it. No, he doesn't say it's selfish. He says that was a characterization. But he wants us as Western people to take it to the streets,
yes,
as they say. Take it to the streets.
And yeah. How we take it to the streets.
Yes.
I think it is a clash between each to the Western mindset. And I think that sometimes I do feel there was a kind of privilege in sitting that we don't.
Yes. Yes. We're all
I might be pathetic to that point. But it struggle within me, you know, once we get enlightened, or if we get enlightened, then what?
Then what? Then what do we do? How do we help? How do we help? But what, you know, Howie last time talked about generosity as one of the great attributes. Part of generosity is saying, how can I help? I feel full. I feel alive. I feel resourceful and energetic. How can I help? It's a naturally arising question. Are we over? We're a little over time. That's why people are getting restless. So let's just sit for a few more minutes and just gather the scatter for just a little more before we go out into the world and our senses begin to eat life again. Just taking an opportunity to be intimate with the here and now. So let's just take a moment to offer the benefits of our practice to those immediately around us, to those people around us that we don't know, to creatures that are not human, to beings, all beings, visible, invisible, and express the sincere wish that all beings avoid the causes of sadness, sorrow, and suffering. And all beings attract the causes and conditions of happiness and joy and liberation. And most important, all beings know the deep peacefulness. Of being free of causes and conditions. You had a good...
I said I had a quick question.
Oh, yes.
I know you practice at college or something.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know anything about children?
Not so much.
Okay.
Why?
Just wondering. I have a son who's 7, and he is as prone to anxiety as his mother and father.
Yes.
And